This is the Empire Podcast. Released March 14th, 2021. Episode 534, sponsored by Mouser Electronics. Firmware update capabilities.
Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
What's up, nerd?
Not much here, man. Just, building stuff, writing firmware, stuff that you don't want to talk about usually. So no big
firmware,
deal.
Firmware, come on. This is an electronics podcast, isn't it? Firmware's not real electronics.
But do you have any electronics that doesn't have firmware on it these days?
That's always in the back of my mind. A recent project I'm thinking about, it's like, can I do this without firmware?
I think there's benefits to it if you can, but I think about like power supplies with maybe an input's like a potentiometer. There's other downsides to doing that sort of thing, but it's not many things anymore, you know?
No, I know. It's like, new version of the microcurrent. It's like, do I have to put a micro in it? It's like, it's one of those things. Although, some auto ranging stuff I'm thinking about doing, at the moment, it's like, I can do that all in analogy. Mm-hmm. It just I have a bunch of comparators and I have some, logic in there that decides which, when to switch and where and.
Yeah, but then, then your troubleshooting method is swapping out resistors.
That is
a slow process.
It's, putting in chips and debugging them and, I know. But it's just, it's more elegant.
I don't think I agree with that.
You don't? No. You think it's more elegant to put in a little 10-cent micro and program it than it is to...
I mean, well, here's the thing, Dave. When I was working at test equipment companies, they didn't... the auto ranging was also, it had indicators there. It had protection that was like fast switch stuff. But a lot of the range stuff is all controlled by an old processor anyway. So it's been done like this for a while in that exact.
Yeah, I know. Goodness, it's like, but still, does it have to be?
The thing is, you're not bad at writing it either. I mean, like you write some Arduino stuff, that's no problem. But it's just, you just don't want to. I think you're out of the habit, right? That's the real thing.
Yeah, it's just, probably. Yeah, I don't do it all the time. It's just annoying.
And I do find it's a habit thing. Like when back into it, like I'm back in a cycle right now and I feel good. Like I feel like I know what I'm doing. I've got the latest tool chain going. I've got, or the latest IDE, like all that stuff seems to work. And, that feels good. But then, you take a break for like a month and just a month even. And it's just like, it all falls out the other side of my head.
Yeah. And it's like on some machines here, I don't even have any tool chains installed for that kind of stuff because I haven't touched it since I last nuked my machine or something,
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I told you, I've been playing around with having like a virtual machine, so I actually pay for VMware now. Because there's like really good low level connections. Like I used to use VirtualBox and I didn't like it. But VMware is great for like low level connection to like a USB to UART kind of chip or similar. Like it'll just pass right through, no problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. So basically at that point you can have, people listening to this right now, the software people, yes, I know there's other things like Docker and all that other stuff. It's like, I don't want that. Not right now. but having like continuity between machines, that part's kind of nice.
Right.
The downside is if they're running Windows and VMware, it's kind of clunky.
Yeah.
It's doable, but clunky. So.
Got it. I like to keep my development system so simple that it's like, if I have to set it up, like it's just like stock. Like I like keeping everything like stock install, So I just download the latest version and just load in my source code and go. There's nothing fancy. It's not setting up everything like David did for the micro supply where I did that video where it was like, an hour just installing all these different types of software so that you could have this optimized software in development environment, which I'm sure is great when you actually get down to it. But
But the complexity goes up and so like more points of failure too.
Yeah, exactly. So I just like using the stock standard stuff and then just the source code just runs. It's not dependent on anything else. So because I did that 1K video, like my 1024th video was 1K, where I took like 20 year old assembly source code and I simply insert for a pick and I simply installed the latest version of, you know, pick, you know, MP Lab X or whatever it is.
Oh, yeah. Right.
I simply installed the latest one, and all I did was took that existing source code, cut and pasted, and with no experience in MP Lab at all, I actually had that compiled and working with no issues in like 5 minutes. Yeah. Like, it worked like 20, 25 years later. Like, wow.
Yeah, that kind of continuity thing for like, especially for like industrial products and things like that, man, it's nice to have for sure.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. Like, I thought, oh, no way it's going to work first go. There's going to be some quirk. And no, I just chose the old chip, which they don't even, they probably don't even sell that particular one anymore or whatever. And it was like, yeah, it just compiled and worked and actually made the binary. And then I used a programmer. I programmed the binary and boom, absolutely incredible. So, yep.
Yeah, that's great.
Something to be said for keeping things simple like that. So the higher the complexity chain you go up, the more you're dependent on so many other, you know, especially if you're running like an RTOS or something like that, you know, you're running and all these, you know, stacks and layers of things and things like that. Oh, yeah. There's just so many things to break.
When I'm doing Zephyr stuff and you like do like a pull on the latest thing, it's just like, it's, I mean, I don't know. So you've probably never seen a Zephyr install either though, but like
no. It
pulls in all of these different like SDKs from different vendors.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yep. Yeah.
Right. So it's all these, but basically it's all these packages for like ST and Nordic and like all of the vendors and NXP and all these other ones, you know, they all have like their latest version of the code, and you go and update Zephyr, which like references these. And it's just like sitting there scrolling for like minutes and minutes of just pulling down the latest versions. So yeah.
Wow.
Although I did find out that so Zephyr does have like a long-term stable release, just like Linux does, like Ubuntu does.
Yep.
Another one of those is coming out soon too. I haven't played with that in the past. I always use kind of the standard like main repository, but yeah, it's interesting like how they're moving to that model.
Got it. Ah, bloody software tools. They're just pain in the ass.
Yeah. I mean, well, the other thing is you could find someone to work on it again, right? I mean, you worked with David, of course, on the other stuff, but...
Oh, yeah, no, if I wanted to pick it up again, yeah, I wouldn't do it myself. I'd just get someone who knows those systems and go, hey, you know, here it is.
Right.
Go for it. They'll spend a day or two coming up to speed, you know?
Right. You become like a project manager at that point, which you know, its own set of challenges, but might fit better for what you're trying to do.
Yeah, exactly. So... anyway, yeah, but it's always in the back of my mind. I can't help it. It's the elegance thing of like, oh, can I just do this without a micro? It's, you know, I can't. Sue me. Yep.
All right. The paperwork is on the way.
All right. Oh, boy. All right. We unfortunately have to start off this week with some sad news, which just came out last night, that Gary Johnston. You may not know the name, but anyone in Australia, Gary Johnston, founder and CEO of JCar, one of our, there's only two remaining electronic stores, like ones where you can actually go in and actually buy parts, right?
Right.
Yeah, he sadly passed away yesterday. He was only 71, which is not old these days, you know? But yeah.
Right, yeah, so, right. Without, yep. Yeah, like septuagenarians and such, or above, that's 70, whatever. What's 100? Octogenarian, nonagenarian,
decagenarian or something?
Centenarian.
Okay.
Yeah, right. Probably right. Century,
yep.
Right? Yeah.
Yep. And it's sad because, like, I always wanted to interview him. And it's like, oh, God, I should have taken the opportunity. You know, he called me up a couple of times over the years to discuss stuff. And it's like, oh, yeah, I should, you know, arrange to go meet him and have an interview. And, yep. Never got a chance, unfortunately.
Is there maybe there's stuff that people could watch, or like are there interviews of him online?
Yes, I will link one in. Cole von Moller.
Oh, okay.
Did a big interview with him. He released that last year, I think. So he's got some extra footage which he may actually release, but it's not really related. But yeah, it's not like a 45-minute interview talking about, you know, how he founded the company and all sorts of stuff. So we will link that one in.
What is what's the status of JCar these days in Australia? I mean, are they still kicking?
Yeah. I've got I go down to my local JCar store when I need, you know, a transistor or a chip or something that I need, or some parts, something like that. Yeah, I still go down there and they still sell the parts. Of course, they've got the farty novelty gadgets and everything else. That's how they actually make a living, right? And, you know, and the flashy LED displays and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, they still have all the little trays behind the counter. and you can go in and you can get your 4000 series CMOS chip, you know. And
right, it's probably the same ones that were on sale when you were a kid too.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, the same stock. That's it. Right. Might it still work?
Yeah, I mean that is nice to have. I mean it's tough to keep that business alive, you know, like.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, we talked about Fry's 2 weeks ago, right? Fry's is gone.
Yeah, they're gone-ski. Yeah.
So my Micro Center is probably my only real thing that I have.
So did Fry's actually have individual chips? I can't remember.
They had, like, I think some blister pack style stuff.
Right. I thought they might have.
Yeah. It only would have been, it wasn't like Radio Shack was where there's drawers. I think it would have been more like, so if an Adafruit or a SparkFun was selling like a loose chip, you could probably get it like that. So definitely harder to get and definitely pricey.
Yep.
You know, when you're in a bind, that's what you need. So yeah, whatever.
Anyway, Cole put on Twitter and I retweeted it as like Gary Johnson famously said, while blood is coursing through my veins, you will still find a 1 meg resistor on the shelves at JK. It's like, you know, so yeah, hopefully that doesn't end with his passing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I hope it doesn't change. But it's amazing. Even a small country like this, we have two, JCar and Altronics.
Yeah.
You can go into, actually Altronics is technically better because they do more surface mount stuff as well. You can actually go in there and buy like surface mount parts in like, you know, 10 per icon of tape. So yeah, you can actually get surface mount stuff off the shelf. So, but then well, of course we've got RS components and Farnell, of course. I still call them Farnell Element 14.
Yeah, I think it all comes down to density, population density, right? So I think living in Sydney probably helps. And then also the fact that, like, because Australia's, you know, a limited size, there's probably a pretty realistic conversation internally about, like, growth. And then they didn't get out over their skis and, like, you know, do the Radio Shack thing where they have 4,000 stores and they tried to grow like a, you know, a large conglomerate does.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, then when things go south, it's like they have nothing to support that huge overhead they have. So JCar probably just was doing a little bit more conservatively and that's what helps them stick around. So
yeah, they've only got like 10 stores. Oh, they had small like network dealers where if you were like a repair shop or something, you could be like a JCar satellite dealer or whatever the term was,
where
you could order stuff
something.
You could order stuff in and, you know, do it. But yeah, that was before the internet, and then the internet came along and so
and what happened next, Dave? what happened next?
Anyway, but yeah, it's always handy, but I have always wondered why they still do it. It's because guys like Gary Johnston were still in charge and they said, I don't care.
Right.
I want all these shelves.
I don't care about the profits. Yeah, I care about the experience.
Yep.
Yeah.
You can go in and you can buy your 10K pot. You know, they go in there and they have the drawers. You can ferret through all the drawers. There's all the connectors all in the little drawers that you can pull out and walk, you know. Yeah, it's great. So handy.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, you can't make a business doing that. It's why they have to sell everything else. So
that's right. Yeah.
Still, you know.
But they're still around versus a Radio Shack, which is a nut.
They're still around. They're doing great. Yeah. They sponsor football teams here and they do, you know.
Nice.
They're
good for them.
You know, fairly big. Because, like, JCar is the, like, people know, they've done branding fairly well, you know, and especially by sponsoring, you know, football teams. Because here in Australia, like, you know, football's a big, huge thing. And it's like,
Australian rules football, yeah.
Well, that league, actually.
Oh, whatever. But
yeah, whatever. Come on. Anyway.
Hey. If anyone's going to bastardize the name football, it's Americans stealing it from the Europeans, okay?
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
And yeah, so they've done well. So people who, you know, like Tandy had that name and then Dick Smith had that name. Dick Smith gave up parts like early 2000s, probably, something like that. That's the last time they, you know, they stopped selling parts. They were taken over by the suits finally came to the conclusion that this is bullshit, you know.
I always felt like they were closer to a Radio Shack. I guess Tandy as well, right?
Tandy, Radio Shack. And it was Tandy here, of course. There was no Radio Shack name. It was like, and you get the little blister packs and stuff like that from Tandy, but they stopped that probably the 90s, you know, something. Oh no, probably into the 2000s as well. Maybe, but yeah, once those ended, then people knew, you know, like, because your average Joe might need, you know, the connectors broken on their widget thing. And Joe Average might have a soldering iron at home or something. Or they go, oh, okay. Like, it's really expensive
better
to buy
a
new one.
A 2.5 diameter barrel jack.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They go in there and buy their 2.5 mil barrel jack and they, you know, yeah. And they actually repair their own thing. So it's, that's been the go-to place.
Hard to keep a business going over time, but yeah, I get it. Yeah.
I don't know how Altronics still do it because they've technically got a much better range than J-Car, yet they're not known. But they've only got like, there's one store here in Sydney and there's like one store in every major capital city. So there's only like five stores Australia-wide or something.
Yeah.
There's not that many, but still, you know, they don't have the same branding as J-Car do. So, fascinating. Anyway, rip Gary Johnston.
Yeah,
so,
it's too bad.
Yeah. Let's hope they keep it up.
Well, speaking of companies that are no longer around, I mean, obviously J-Car is, but we were talking about the other ones.
Who's gone tits up this week?
MIPS. Actually, it's the opposite. They're back from the dead. So MIPS is the... Yep. They make the core that was in like a bunch of microchip stuff, right?
Right. Yes, yes. Yeah. The PIC32 is based on the MIPS architecture. They famously chose the MIPS architecture over the ARM architecture.
Right, right. So the news this week is that MIPS is now RISC-V.
Guess who's back again.
Yeah, right. I don't quite understand this. I mean, I think there must be some kind of business behind it, and now they're basically like, well, we can't develop the technology any further on the MIPS side of things.
Yep.
And the official statement says, we're developing a new industry-leading standards, eighth generation architecture, which we will be basing on the open source RISC-V processor standard, the ISA in this case.
Yep.
Yeah, that's weird, huh?
But ironically, RISC-V or RISC-V? We did this argument.
We've done this every time.
Yep.
It's five. Yeah, it's RISC-V.
RISC-V is based on MIPS.
Nope.
So apparently that's where it came from apparently, or that's what they were trying to do better. They were trying to do a better MIPS. So apparently flamed. Oh yeah, I'm pretty sure. Pretty sure.
So I mean the ISA is not, I mean, so like remember the RISC-V is the instruction set architecture.
Yes.
And so
reduced instruction set. That's what RISC stands for. RISC is reduced instruction set.
Oh, sorry, what did I say? I said RISC instruction set. Yes. I don't remember what I said, yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, it's interesting that it's like, this is especially coming out of the bankruptcy piece. So, I don't know. We'll
see how
that goes.
Companies never die. They, you know, there's still money to be, when there's money to be had, still, they'll just spin and repivot, and the CEO, the original MIPS CEO is still there or something, isn't he, or something like that, and they're doing what a RISC-V now, so okay, but under the MIPS branding.
What's interesting about the, so like taking this on, I think one thing you would gain from this is basically all the compiler support that's already there for RISC-V stuff, like, and I'm just continually surprised by that. So I was just,
well, it's not that MIPS didn't have it,
right, but it's adjacent, right? So if you had a bunch of tools built for RISC-V because all these people are building out tool chains that support it or similar, right?
Yeah.
And then MIPS requires another because they have a different instruction set. It's like, even though it might be branded MIPS, it's like then could start to use the tools that are out there, so compilers and similar things that basically have the same instructions at the lowest level,
right?
So I feel like this could be a money saving, you know, like just thinking about how these companies are approaching RISC-V stuff, it's like it's a money saving thing if nothing else, right?
Okay.
It's, you know, there's a standardization piece, but then from a business perspective, it's, I'm excited about it if people are coming in, they're like, yeah, we're going to standardize because it's cheaper, and it's like, great, fine with me, you know. I think that helps to build, instead of like these vertically integrated companies, it starts to build more like crossover type stuff.
Right. Now, the interesting thing about this is people might think, oh, what happens to the microchip PIC32? That's based on the MIPS architecture. Oh, like, I'm sure they're fine. I mean, I might actually contact Microchip and see what the deal is. Maybe we can get him on the show.
Cool, that'd be great.
Yeah, and you know, Steve Zangy, butchering that last name, I'm sure.
Give Steve a shout.
Yep. And see what their future is and stuff like that. Obviously, they would have, you know, a company like that would not have been dumb enough to sign an agreement that was reliant upon MIPS staying solvent, right? No. It was like, we're licensing your architecture. We want it forever. Here's the money, bugger off. If you guys go under, that's your business. We don't care. We're still making our MIPS chips.
I felt like MIPS was closest to ARM. I mean, I'm sure I'm wrong about this stuff, but like in terms of like the business model, in terms of licensing and generating IP that was being used elsewhere.
Yes.
Yeah, they weren't building MIPS processors or anything like that. It's just the architecture.
You could not buy a MIPS chip that I'm aware of.
Well, there's some tie-in with MIPS. I thought it was a name conflation, but when Forrest Mims was on the show, he mentioned something about MIPS.
Did he?
Yeah.
Really?
I'm looking it up now. There was something, it may have been just a conflation of the names, but I thought there was something there.
Okay.
Oh no, MITS.
MITS, MITS. Ed, what's his name? Sadly, he's no longer with us either. He designed the Altec.
Ed Roberts.
That's right. MITS.
Yeah, I totally knew that the whole time, everyone. Right. I just wanted to do a callback to the Forrest Mims show because we had Forrest on the show.
That's why I was surprised. That's like Forrest Mims and MIPS. That didn't make sense. MITS. Yes.
Yeah.
MITS.
You know, there's just so many. There's only so many acronyms you can have. So. Yes. And we're talking about Radio Shack too. So Forrest was in my head, I'm sure. Yeah. You know.
No,
so
MITS. Whatever. MITS stood for something, instrumentation and telemetry systems.
That's right. Micro instrumentation and telemetry.
Micro instrumentation telemetry systems. Yes. MITS.
Yeah. Good memory.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I know my computer history. That's all tied in with the Altair and, you know, the whole thing. And technically, Bill Gates was not an employee of MITS, whereas Paul Allen, co-founder of Microsoft, he technically was an employee of MITS at the time. So, but Bill Gates, he was never actually employed by MITS. So, back in the early Microsoft days, because they basically moved to Microsoft moved to Albuquerque to be next door to MITS because that was their one big customer. It was like,
was that the one that you were you refurbing an Altair recently, or was that a different computer?
No, not an Altair. No.
What were you refurbing?
I was refurbing something.
You did something with like a display on some like
old
computer.
That was an old compact portable. Is that the one you're talking about?
Oh yeah, probably. Yeah.
Yeah, I've still got that on my bench. Yeah. No, that's good. That's an IBM compatible thing.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Yep.
So it was like later.
We're talking mid.
Got it.
Early to mid 80s, not mid 70s here. But I mean, a lot of people don't know that. Is that Microsoft?
Dave, come on, man. You're in pre-Chris era here. So.
Right. Yeah, I know. Yeah. Yep. You weren't even born when Microsoft moved their headquarters to Albuquerque, which was next to a strip joint, I do believe.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, there's many books on the history of all of this stuff, which is great. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy thinking about that stuff too. Like people in, you know, at those crossroads of like technology or whatever too, it's not like they were like thinking it was going to, you know, they knew it was exciting and this big thing, but they didn't know that they were going to like make history books about stuff too, you know?
No, they were just doing cool stuff. That was just nerds doing cool stuff, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Just nerds hanging out.
Yeah. And they followed where the action was. It was like when the action was in Silicon Valley, you know, before it was even coined Silicon Valley, that's where you went. If the action was in Albuquerque with MITS and the Altair, that's where you went. You know, it's like, yeah. So you just awesome. Follow the nerdery.
Yeah. I wonder where the nerdery is these days. I have to imagine I don't have my finger on the pulse of it. I think these days, at least in the US, everybody's at home, so there's also that.
Can we float our opinions on this? What is the future of Silicon Valley?
Well, no one's ever come up with this before.
No.
nor where will be the next Silicon Valley. I've never seen any headlines that say that.
It can't go back to the way it was. You know, like
you mean
post COVID. Sorry?
I said like a fruit orchard, like it, like it started orchard, out as.
Right, no, yeah, it's like, yeah, where like if your company wasn't there, you did not exist. Whereas now, right, that's not really, you know, that's not really the case. I mean, you've got Rocket Labs; they're in New Zealand, you know, launching rockets in bloody New Zealand, and they don't have to be in near SpaceX in bloody California to make it happen, right?
Yeah, I think that there is a general distribution of technology. I think there's that sort of thing, but I push back against the notion that people are going to stop doing the office thing.
Oh, they're not going to stop doing it, but will new startups feel the compelling need? Like, if you're a startup in the US, you simply went to Silicon Valley. If you're a tech startup, right, you wanted your presence to be in Silicon Valley. But is that now the case?
Maybe,
is that still
maybe
the case?
San Francisco too, right? I mean, like, yeah, I mean, there's...
Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
I don't know. I think it all comes down to, like, talent bases, right? Really, you know, people think about the geography a lot more than the talent base, though.
Yeah,
like talent and then money, right? That's the two things that I think about. And I don't think Sand Hill Road is going anywhere. That's where like all the VCs are,
right?
You know, there's more money out there. You know, well, money's so cheap these days that it's like, okay, there's tons of investment capital everywhere, but it's like, but that's still where a lot of the tech stuff happens. That's where, like, if you want to really get frothy, like, valuation craziness, I think that you still have to at least visit there.
Right.
Whether or not you have to, like,
yeah,
plop down a, you know,
an actual
of operations,
yeah, an expensive rented office there with,
yeah,
wanky, right, furniture, yeah,
right. But I think there's a lot of talent in the area still. I just think that,
oh, of course,
you know, I think the interesting thing will be, okay, so all this migration has been happening because of COVID, and that's going to drive some of the, at least the short term effects, I think. You know, people buying houses more in the suburbs or just out in the wilderness, you know. Mm-hmm. I've been watching people, Caleb Kraft from Make, he actually just posted a video about his using his Starlink, and he's like in rural Missouri.
Right.
And so,
yeah,
it's like, you know, like, so people like Caleb can get much better connectivity then, kind of being more further out. So I think there will be more normalized remote work. But I think from like a headquarters standpoint, I think it'll all continue to coalesce. Because I think that if people are chasing young talent still wants to be where other young people are.
Yep.
And
right,
that's cities. And so it's just going to keep doing that. Maybe it'll distribute a little bit more into other big cities, but I don't think that it'll appreciably go away.
I don't think it'll be the showstopper it once was. If you really don't want to have an office in Silicon Valley, you don't have to be
exactly
successful. It's like,
right, you might be still flying into, you know, San Jose airport to go visit some of the money bags, but like, I don't know.
Well, they're all moving to Texas now, aren't they? Everyone's in Texas, you know?
Yeah, Texas, yeah.
Yeah.
I think Silicon Valley it's a terribly laid out area too. Like, it's beautiful. Like, the weather is amazing there, right? It's like,
it's great.
Really nice weather in like Sunnyvale and stuff. But
yeah,
but it's just like, it's like concrete city. I mean, like, it's just like you have to drive a lot of places. Maybe I just didn't visit the right places. Don't kill me if you live there and you love it, but.
Yeah, no, that's the impression I got, yeah. It's not
a city to me. It's like, it's, you know, San Jose is a city, but like Silicon Valley is just like so sprawling that it's like, you know, it's not quite suburbs because it's so built up, but it's not a city. It's not, you can't live there without a car. You can live there with like a train and a bike maybe, but like,
right,
but like cars are kind of the name of the game, it feels like.
Got it.
This and more on the Dave and Chris Lifestyle Podcast. Here in the Amp Hour, we're interested in sponsors that help us educate our listeners. Today, we're talking again with Paul Galata from Mouser Electronics. He's going to discuss wide bandgap semiconductors, and I asked him about how they're different from other semiconductors.
Traditionally, people have used silicon, but if silicon has a bandgap in the low ones, what we're really talking about today is wide bandgap products that have been developed that have a bandgap in the neighborhood of 3 to 4 electron volts. And so some ones that are very typical that are being employed today include silicon carbide, also called SiC, S-I-C, and gallium nitride, also called GaN, G-A-N. So let's just say we have 3 times as much electron volts available to us. What that means physically, when it comes down to what's happening with electronics, is that they're able to achieve higher switching frequencies. So they can be turned on faster, on and off faster. And anytime we can increase the switching frequencies, we're going to be able to operate everything that we're doing downstream in the design at higher speeds.
So we're driving higher frequencies, but why does that matter? What are the applications of these new types of semiconductors?
An important one that's really driving a lot of the train is automotive. Everybody's trying to store electronic energy in the car, so that's huge. Renewable energies, things like solar and wind and those type of things, those require power inverters, things to change what's coming in and get it into an electrical format, as well as energy storage. But there's also things like 5G that's coming on to give us increased capabilities in terms of how connected everything is, how fast they're operating. And wide band gap helps that. Specifically in something like 5G, one of the technologies that's underpinning that is a thing called massive multiple input, multiple output. That's often called MIMO, M-I-M-O. And this type of technology will be enabled by wide bandgap technologies. You can also use these products in industrial. Since these parts and these technologies and these products do that more efficiently, these help industry be more efficient to produce things for lower energy costs and the like.
The higher bandgap allows for higher switching frequencies, but it took me a second to understand that this would actually make for lower switching losses in converters and similar. Paul explains it more.
We can only make silicon turn on and off so fast before a bunch of residual effects essentially compromise its performance and make it more difficult for us to achieve the necessary switching frequency. Another thing that also happens with that is even if we do lots of external things to silicon to make it perform at its best, in order to do that, we have to add a variety of products, things like capacitors and other various things to optimize that. And that takes up size, and it takes up additional costs and complexities just because you have to do all this optimization to try to make the silicon do its very best. With wide band gap, you get to use less components. And so that simplifies everything.
To learn more about wide band gap semiconductors and how you can use them in your designs, check out the Mouser Electronics application page on the topic. You can go to theamphour.com/bandgap to get a direct link to that page and learn more. That's theamphour.com/bandgap. And now back to the show.
Speaking of changes, friend and guest of the show, Lewis Rossman.
Oh yeah,
has just announced. He released a video last night. Surprise of absolutely no one is that he's now changing. He's basically changing his full-time job.
Oh yeah,
pretty much. Yeah, he's announced that. Paraphrasing, but yeah, we'll link in his video. You can go his announcement video. It's like, here's my change in life. This is what I'm doing as a full-time job now. He's going to spend the next 2 years now. If you don't know, real estate. Lewis Rossman, of course, does his repair videos, right? He's got his repair shop in New York, and he does his famous repair videos. He does his famous real estate rants. He does, you know, all sorts of, you know, business rant videos. Very popular, right? And so he's decided, nope, not doing that anymore. What is more important, what's more worthy of my time, I'm going to spend the next 2 years fighting for the right to repair. Thing.
He's taking
right?
that full-time thing.
He's taking that on full-time. That's going to be his focus. I don't think he said he's going to stop like doing videos on other stuff, but it might just be an occasional hobby thing or something, as it always has been.
That's great.
No, he's going to focus on that full time.
Yeah, no, I think that mission in life is great. What's interesting about the right to repair stuff is like, I kind of feel like the biggest impact he could have is to go and like lobby the EU. Because like if the EU does something,
it becomes tentacles everywhere.
The USB standard stuff, like, man, you know, people complain about that at first, but like, I love it. I am so not sick of having, do you remember like every phone having like just a separate charger standard? It was so bad.
Yes, I know. It was a nightmare.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now it's all USB. Well, now it's like, well, there's, you know, is it USB-C? Is it USB-C or is it USB micro? You know,
I don't care.
You know, exactly. It's one or the other. Exactly.
You know, and then Apple has their own thing still. I don't know how they get away with that, but like that kind of like driving standardization, like, you know, people can have all kind of political views of whether or not that's good or not, but man, it's coalescing around cheaper hardware is, that is my politics.
I just had to ferret around yesterday for a suitable matching plug pack for my old Canon camcorder. It's like, totally. Oh God.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. It sucks.
Yep. No, they couldn't just use a standard DC barrel jack. It was this little mini barrel jack thing, and it was like, you know, some oddball voltage or something.
Yeah,
and
it's like a 0.5 millimeter inner diameter or something crazy.
Yeah, so something like that, right?
Yeah.
And, ah, it's a pain in the ass. So anyway, so that's a good focus because he doesn't want Ray, because at the moment, Right to Repair is like kind of like his name's associated with that. And he said he's got so much baggage that he doesn't want to damage the movement. Because people don't want to, you know, dig up all this stuff on him because he's said a lot of controversial, you know, in quote marks, right? Controversial. Yeah. It wouldn't be hard to pull up a controversial quote from Lewis Rossman. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's
and
right.
And and, you know, and so he wants to now, I don't know the mechanisms of it behind it, but apparently there's some money in play now behind it. There's been money put behind it, and he wants to, you know, make it more formal so it's beyond him. He wants to make it like a big formal movement kind of thing. Yep.
That's great.
And although he'd be driving it, this would be his full-time job and commitment. He doesn't want it to be focused around him as a personality anymore.
Yeah.
So,
I think to you have to make it an idea instead of a person, right?
Yes.
That's
right.
True of any movement, I think.
That's it. That's great. Yeah, it's great.
How do you feel about the whole Right to Repair thing? I mean, like, We've had Lewis on the show twice now, and we
had him one dedicated to the Right to Repair episode, and that was very popular. Yep. We'll link that one in because he goes through a lot of the stuff. I think it's we should damn well demand this of all of our products. You should be able to have a schematic. There was an argument on his recent video. It's like schematics or die. You know, it's like, you know, it's if you don't provide me the schematics, forget it. You are not, I don't care what other token steps you take towards Right to Repair. It's like, well, you don't give me the schematic, screw you, right? We are not going to promote or endorse you as being repair friendly.
Yeah. It's like, that is the line in the sand.
Yeah. That is the line in the sand. That is the minimum bar you have to get over. To be able to, you know, say that you're doing something. It's kind of like open hardware. Like, you know, there's a minimum bar that you need to jump over to call yourself open hardware.
Yep.
Yeah, it's the same for Right to Repair. And I think that's a good baseline, having the schematic available. But then again, you could argue that, the schematic's useless then if you serial number parts, like you actually tie parts into serial numbers so that you can't even salvage a part from another unit and put it in a repair unit, it won't work because it's been serialized, right? And it's baked into the software and stuff. Oh yeah, we're open. Here's the schematic. Good luck. You know, gotcha. And it's like, you can't buy the chips because they're customized, right? Or TI or something. Apple will use a TI charger chip or whatever, right? And they won't sell it to anyone else except Apple.
Right. It's like, it's a custom, right?
Holy crap. Right? Yeah.
Yep.
So even if Apple actually released the schematics, if you can't buy the parts or they're serialized, well, no, you're screwed. So, you know, there's got to be some minimum thing there. So,
yeah. Yeah. I wish there was some kind of push to do more custom or not custom, sorry, like standardization on footprints too. Like, you know, like a default fallback footprint that everything had. Now again,
it's the utopia that's never going to happen. There's always going to be reasons why companies want X footprint. You know, there's just that's why they exist in the first place.
If we're talking about like things that we want, that's what I want. I know it's not realistic, but that's what I want.
Fair enough. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh goodness. Anyway, yes, the Right to Repair thing. It needs to be, and unfortunately, it's a lot of. It has to. This is one of the things that. Well, you can put public pressure on companies to do it, and those that do it will get actually rewarded with sales. Right. That's the idea. You shouldn't need government intervention for this sort of thing. The free market should take care of it. You know, you should be able to put enough pressure on companies that, hey, we won't buy your product unless I can repair it myself. And the first company that comes out and says, hey, look, we release the schematic, here's the parts, or you can buy them from DigiKey or whatever, you know.
Yeah, it could be a differentiator in the marketplace, right?
So the first company that do that, you can potentially do this without legislation. The market can do it. But ultimately, companies just aren't that easily convinced, right?
Right. There's probably not enough of a push yet. But I think that's what Lewis will be working on.
Yeah, so you've got to lobby. And they've had some wins. They've had some wins in the US and in the EU too, I think. And there's a right to repair thing going on here, so maybe I should investigate that more.
Yeah, yeah.
Although I'm not in the repair business as such. Like, you know, that's actually Lewis's bread and butter, you know.
Right.
So,
yeah, yeah.
But still, with my audience, maybe I can help out. So
sure.
Never know. Sure. Yep.
Yeah, that'd be great.
But ultimately, yeah, it will require a combination of government legislation, as you were saying, like the EU coming in and mandating that, yes, all new mobile phones must use a USB for charging. None of this proprietary rubbish anymore, you know, mm-hmm. and that got the job done, right? So, yeah, hopefully something, yeah, similar sort of thing. But it's going to need both. It's going to need both solutions.
Yeah, right.
But, yeah. No. Mm. See, I don't know. Like, if I was a marketing person at these companies, I'd go, look, no other companies. Like, marketing is doing something nobody else does, right? Being the first, making a big splash, right? That can...
Yeah, you know, but I think internally, if you were like, hey, I know how to get more views or more attention, we should give away our IP. And it's like, regardless of whether or not the fact that we believe
that
a schematic is truly IP,
yeah.
It is still IP, right? I mean, like... it at least is perceived as IP internally. I think that's the big thing. So I think that's probably the uphill battle. That it's like your schematic is not that interesting, you know? Like,
That's a t-shirt right there. Your schematic is not that interesting.
Yeah, right.
But give it to me, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, that could be the back.
Yeah. It's like, no, because there's so much that goes into copying a product. And it's like, it's showing that even if you don't release the schematics, well, China can just, you know, these factories in China can just copy your product anyway, right?
That's
right. So it's not, you know, doesn't really help him. But, you know, it's not like nobody's talking about actually releasing the original source files and, you know, things like that or releasing, you know, the PCB files to make it trivial for a company to copy your product.
Exactly. Yeah, like what is the real goal of the thing?
Yeah. Well, that's the open source hardware debate as well. It's like, well, how much do you give away? Is a PDF schematic enough? Are the original, you know, the original schematic and files, schematic and PCB files? What do you do about the BOM? What do you do about your supplier information? Do you give everyone everywhere, you know, make it a turnkey thing so that anyone can just, you know, turn a key and manufacture your product? It's like, how far do you go? And well, that's up to each individual.
And you can go and debate all this on April 9th, Open Source Hardware Summit. Open Hardware Summit's coming up on April 9th.
Virtual, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, it's virtual.
Yeah. See, if it was here in Australia, it'd be the real deal.
Yeah, but nobody could get there. We'd be quarantined for 2 weeks first.
No, everyone in Australia could go, you know.
Oh, okay. Well, you should do one, man.
Right.
Take advantage, you know, like you can get together. I highly recommend it.
I could start up the EV blog meetup again. Yep.
There you go. Yeah. Yes, you could.
I don't think there's any limits. I could do the EV blog meetup and cram 500 nerds into a room and
exactly
with
people
zero
just,
masks,
like, spitting all over each other, you know,
no problem.
Like just,
yep. salivating over all the latest hardware and
there you go,
possible, yep. Oh boy. Man. Anyway, yes, Lewis.
Cool. Yeah. We'll definitely link in that video.
Yep.
Something you were mentioning with that. I think, you were mentioning the replacing the connector on a thing. And I was thinking about one of my recent designs. I did something that like I don't usually do on prototypes, but I'm really, really glad I did. And that is, can you guess what I did on my recent prototypes?
No.
I designed in wire to board connectors, whereas normally in the previous revision, I was like soldering wires directly to the, like
pads.
Just like some pin headers.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Man, let me tell you, that makes such a difference, you know.
No.
It's just like I know. The thing that I always get scared off about though is the custom
cable
piece,
the custom assembly. You don't want to have a custom little crimping tool to make the crimpy things and then push them into the connector. What a pain in the ass. Who wants that?
Exactly.
Just put a hole in the board with a pad, just wire it on, be a man.
That's right.
You know,
exactly. Well, I don't know, yeah, but the thing that I figured out is that you can buy pre-crimp cable from distributors now. Well, not now. I'm sure yes, you have you been can. Able to for yeah. a while. I found it and I'm like, oh, well, that's easier. And like, this is like super tiny stuff. And yeah, so I just like assemble little cables and I can, you know, do a little a splice.
Isn't like Seed or somebody doing it now? Who's the company that just announced that they're doing cable assemblies? Somebody tweeted it out that you could, somebody, JLC. I think it was JLC, wasn't it? They do custom, I don't know. Don't quote me.
Yeah, I mean, Dirty Prototypes or Dirty Cable used to do that stuff. And I think Seed has a cable service too. And honestly, like I think I mentioned on the show before, like it's not that hard to actually get like cable samples made. It's usually the low volume stuff sucks.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, you know, go on Alibaba, find someone who's making something that looks relatively similar and write him an email and be like, hey, can you change it here, here, and here? And they're like, yeah, of course.
Yeah, and they went in business. Easy peasy, lemon squeezy.
You know, but there is overhead for that. So this was more like when you're like still at the prototype stage, you know, buying those pre-crimps is like real great. So, yeah. So I've been enjoying my my easy connect and disconnect life.
Cool bananas.
Yeah, it's so much better. I don't know.
Well, you could always use like 0.1 inch ribbon cable and headers, you know?
Yeah. So the real thing is like, so like this is also now I built for building out a test stand for this board that I'm building. And like, so like having these peripherals that are just able to like clip in super easy. So like you think about building out that for, you know, if I want to test 10 boards and I do it with like, say a ribbon cable, like you're talking about now, I've desoldered that ribbon cable a couple times and you know, my soldering, it's ugly. you know, and so it's just a much more reliable connection. So,
all right.
You heard it here first, folks. Connectors more reliable than my soldering.
Oh boy. Yeah. That's the age old thing in product design. It goes back before I was born. That was a long time ago. Do you go for an all connector solution? Do you hardwire in? Like when I'm doing a teardown of a product, I go, geez, they've hardwired in these, you know, look, Sony, the bastards, they've like hardwired in these cables, right? They're soldering them in. And how do I get these boards apart? And I've got to unsolder the bloody things just to take the boards out so I can like poke around at them and stuff. It's like, you know, but no, somebody deemed that that was, you know, cost saving or some other, you know, thing that they wanted to do and they weren't going to go, you know, or they would mix them. Like you tear down a product and you go, well, this is half board, nice board to board interconnect and half hardwired soldered. Yeah, yeah. It's like,
who
what
made
the
this
hell?
Decision? Yeah, I want to talk to the manufacturing engineer here, you know?
Yep. Yeah. Nuts.
Yeah. What else should we talk about, Dave?
What would you like to talk about, Chris?
Let's talk about the listener survey, since listener survey was up on the last episode, 533, with Joel Dunsmore. If you haven't heard that, that was a awesome conversation I got to have with him. And yes, we're giving away copies of his book. And so please do fill out our yearly survey. Even if you don't want the book, please fill it out. I may have a goodie or two to throw in that's not that book as well, in case you've already got a copy.
Didn't we forget something in last year's survey and you went, oh yeah, we should have added that.
Yeah, I had that thought and then I was like, yep, oh, I'm out of time. So next year it is. Yeah, I could not remember what it was.
No, I don't remember either of that, but I thought I'd float it anyway because there was something. I'm sure
there
we said
something.
It on the show.
Yeah, it was like, oh, yeah, we definitely did. We definitely did. So, oh, well.
Ah, boy. Yeah, I have to do another survey for my channel. I haven't done one for donkey's years. So I don't know if the data's out of date or what now, you know. Has my audience changed? I don't know.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No idea. So might have to run another one. But I can tell you from experience that even if you do the stuff that the audience, that the survey says that everyone wants, people still get upset anyway. It's like, But 70% of people said they want this video. And it's like, well, no, I don't like it.
We're going to do our own thing regardless. So
yeah, exactly. It's just, it is helpful though.
Yeah, I mean, we love hearing from all of you. I mean, like, that's for sure.
The freeform comment fields are the best. I love scrolling through the
be creative, please. We'd love to hear from you. And, yeah.
Yep. Dave's an asshole. It's like, it's great. Love it.
Did you see I'm encroaching on your space? I did an unboxing video, Dave.
And I have not seen your unboxing video. What? I don't do unboxing videos, really.
I know. It's also a teardown.
Mailbag.
It's also a teardown. It's also a teardown. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. What is it?
It's a dual scope. I mean, it's nothing you haven't seen before.
Oh,
you
okay. No, I've done a dual scope. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, yes. I got a new one. So mine broke.
Oh, is there a new model? Is there?
No, mine broke.
Oh, okay.
I had
how
a beta
did you break
and
it?
I broke it. I was roughhousing with it, and so Matt sent me a new one.
roughhousing with it. Were you throwing it? Is it physical or is it electrical roughhousing?
No, it was physical. I think I'd probably, like something when I was like unplugging the front plate or something like that. So,
right.
Yeah, I don't know what I did. But new one works great. And measuring current, like it's my job. It is my job.
Right. Cool.
Yeah, I know, and I've been doing current measurements on my cellular board, and I'm all excited. I got it all fired up, and I'm like, oh yeah, I'm gonna see these huge spikes, and then the current will go down to nothing because I'm using this tiny little processor.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's 20 milliamps, 25 milliamps, and in idle state. I'm like, what is going on here?
You're expecting 25 microamps or something, and you got 25 milliamps.
I was like oh yeah, it's gonna probably 100 microamps, the NRF52 is really low current, whatever.
And nope, it didn't,
not yet. I have some room to optimize still. It turns out I have an op amp just kind of turned on and sitting there on one of my plug-in boards, and so that takes some current, and the sensors aren't turned off right, and
it's taking tens of milliamps. What is one of those bipolar jobbies?
Yeah, it's a high accuracy.
Right. Yep.
JFET, I think. Yeah. I don't remember what it's on there. 4190 or something.
For those playing along at home, you usually can't get high speed and low noise with low power consumption.
Yeah.
It's like,
there's a trade off somewhere.
Yeah. Yep. It's not gonna happen.
Yeah. Why all the boxes are warm when you turn them all on and it's like, oh, they normalize at 30°C.
Right, yeah. Yeah, but it feels nice. It feels like quality, like it's doing quality electronics in there.
It's got that warm, crunchy measurement capability,
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Tubes. We should go back to tubes, filaments that heat up just for the sake of the...
Well, there's a product that, doesn't have any firmware on it, Dave. You could go back to that.
Is there a tube product with... firmware?
Oh, totally. Yeah. So yeah, sure there's a guy at my meetup in Chicago, Keith. Keith, he built this this cool alarm clock that uses tubes as well. It's the display element.
Yep.
Really, really nice design. It's got an STM32.
He put an STM32 in it. Give me a break.
What?
Come on.
What's the problem? What, you can't source it?
I've done a video on my clock design, all 4000 series CMOS. Thank you very much.
Well, okay.
So?
I mean, it's not just the clock. Yeah, okay. All right. Well,
what else does it do? Bloody multi.
I don't remember. It's been
things.
A while. Dave, it's been a while since I've seen people.
Right. Okay.
Been to a hardware meetup that I got to see other people's work. People should show up at the next meetup that they have and they just have boxes and boxes of projects ready to go,
Right. Everyone's been stuck at home. They've had nothing to do but work on projects,
Yeah.
Yep. Man. How's things there anyway? Are things opening up there again?
The vaccine is going well. It's, I think, 10% of the... No, sorry. 1 in 4... I saw a statistic. 1 in 4 people in the U.S. has had their first vaccine.
Right.
For some people, they only need one shot with the new Johnson & Johnson.
Oh, really? Okay.
But, yeah. It's still, I was looking at an article the other day that there's a New York Times calculator. You put in your health conditions, and your age, everything that, and then it tells you where you are online. And I think I had 240 million people ahead of me.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I'm yes, even though I'm old, I'm I'm bottom of the line. Yep. Mm.
Are you guys getting a vaccine or no? You're not going to.
What, here?
Yeah.
It's free if you want it. You can have it, but you're on a waiting list. They're doing there's this multi-phase rollout thing, and I'm literally in the last. If I if you go through the checkbox, I'm literally in the last. Thing.
It's okay.
The only one less important than me is kids.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah.
Right. Oh, just really strong immune systems, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. It's like, no, I have no comorbidities. I'm, you know, not old. Well, you know, in the scheme of things.
Old-ish, right?
Yep. Yeah. No, I'm not in my 70s, you know, right, something right, like yeah. that. I think it's mild risk over 60s or something. And then once you get in your 70s, once you're in your 8, like highest risk is 80s plus, you know, yeah, so they're like high priority and stuff like that. But no, if you're like, yeah, youngish and fit, and you know, you don't have any other underlying health issues, no, go to the back of the line, you know. So, which is fair enough, you know.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah,
no, totally. They should roll it out to the vulnerable people first. There's our weekly COVID update on the Amp Hour. Groan.
Right.
I just don't watch the news anymore. It's like, no.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
Yep. Yep. Gave up long time ago. I think they're about to fly the helicopter on Mars, aren't they?
I think so. Yeah, I mean,
I think they're close. Aren't they searching for a spot to drop it, to poop it out the back, and then
is that how it works? I haven't seen how it actually
deploys. They physically drop it onto the ground and then move away and they poop it out and and then they stand back a distance so then they can point the camera at it and they let it go. So, that's going to be
I didn't realize how long it's been like in development and also like the constraint. I was watching the Veritasium video on it.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, I just like the speeds that the rotors have to spin at is like really nuts.
Oh yeah, because there's bugger all air there. You know, there's bugger all
air.
It's
like one 100th or something.
1/100th, like I think, something of that order. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like pretty crazy.
Two orders less than here. Yeah, it's a lot. That's why it has to weigh like 100, doesn't it? Was it weigh 400 grams or something? Is that the entire copter?
It's insanely light. And then the method of the mounting too. I don't know if you saw that the board was mounted, or the boards are mounted rather, but they're actually mounted on the outside of the battery pack. And so the whole thing is like coated in like a, you know, like that gold foil stuff that they use for like radiation shielding, whatever. Yep. But then the board, all of the control circuitry is mounted on the outside of the battery pack, I think, because any residual heat from the battery is then also used to help heat the board up, because a lot of the battery power is also being used to heat the board up as well, or to like keep things warm enough. You know, like just resistive elements and stuff. So that's the shitty thing about space, you know?
I'm not sure of the temperature variations of where they landed. I'm not sure of the, you know, I don't think that wasn't their major concern. I think the science location was their major concern.
Because
there are some spots on Mars that can actually get to the 20 degree range, which I don't know what that's Celsius, none of that Fahrenheit rubbish, but that's like, you know, just normal office temperature. Like the standard office temperature that I'm in now is like 23 or something is standard office temperature. Yeah.
Right. So and you can like get places on Mars that actually get that Fahrenheit.
Warm. Yeah. Yeah. So you can get, you know, there are some places that during the day, they do actually get into nice, comfortable temperatures. So technically, if you could walk outside, if you didn't, there weren't other issues, you could, you know.
Yeah, if you were going to asphyxiate and get irradiated and,
all sorts of other things, then, it'd be nice. So,
It feels like the control algorithm on this thing is, like, really, really complex, too, of just, like, having the dual rotor thing and, like, and then how it actually, like, steers. And, it's just there's a lot of science going into this thing, it feels like.
So your odds of it working, of it actually flying?
Oh, I honestly didn't think it wouldn't fly. I guess.
Yeah, no, I think there's zero chance unless something goes wrong. Like there's actually.
Yeah, I could see like hitting something maybe and not being able to recover.
No, I think it'll fly. I think, you know, they've done their test. You know, these things are fairly easy to calculate, although they're still not sure. Like they're, you know.
Yeah, it's a risk profile kind of thing or whatever.
Yeah,
right?
But I think no, it's all, I think it will get off the ground. I think this little puppy will go up. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, and even if they don't know right away, it's going to be they don't know for a couple minutes. What is it? 20 minute? What's the transmit time?
12 minute delay or 14 minutes or something, isn't it? At the moment, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh boy. Anyway, that's going to be very cool. All right, what else we got?
How was your build, your DMM build? Didn't you have a new DMM coming up?
No.
I thought you were doing a rev on a design or something.
No. Nope.
Or maybe it was just released.
Nope. That's someone else. I mean, I've got a new multimeter, but there's nothing to do with revs or new boards or anything. No. Sorry.
Oh, it's just like a new model that's branded or something?
It's a new model that's branded, yeah. Okay. Yes. But that's it. No, sorry. Don't know where you're going with that one.
Okay.
Can we imagine that that was the case? What was your, where were you going?
I was just going to ask how it's going. I mean, honestly, right. Just okay. Like, yeah, like what's new with it?
No, sorry.
Well, what else are you building these days, Dave? I mean, I feel like I can only talk about so much stuff, you know, that I'm building because, you know, it's client stuff.
Right. But, well, you're building more stuff than me.
I know.
It's like, yeah. I'm just too busy making videos and stuff. Although today I am probably going to shoot an update video on the micro supply. It's okay. I'm going to get the box out. The box,
like the project box?
Yep, the project box, which contains all the bits. And yeah, I'm going to do a video.
You should put on like a hat that makes you look like an archaeologist, you know? Like
yeah,
you
right. I ain't going through that.
Make it thematic.
People are going to be disappointed. It's like, no, I'm probably not going to do anything with it. It's like, I was going to maybe talk about this in the video. It's the sunken cost fallacy kind of thing. Mm. You know, it's like,
yeah.
You know, yeah, it was a great idea 10 years ago for this USB power supply. Now I'm thinking, it's not going to be that. Like, if it was actually done and all it required was me to send all the files off and some company makes it, then mm-hmm. I'd probably just do it for kicks, right? And then if it doesn't sell, it doesn't sell, meh. But no, it's like...
Oh, sorry, I misheard you. I thought you were saying microcurrent. You said micro supply.
Micro supply, the little power supply.
Oh, got it.
Yes,
yeah.
The little,
okay.
You know, which looks really funky. And it's got all custom parts in, almost everything in it's custom.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it needs like a new transformer, like it needs a new custom transformer. It needs proper thermal testing and other stuff. And it needs... It's not at a point where I could just turn a key and make some, you know. We were getting fairly close to that. We were going to actually manufacture like 10 or 20 of them and like send out, you know, 10 or 15 of them to various people and actually trial it. So mm-hmm. We weren't getting too far off from that, but there was still work required to do that. So, yeah. And it's,
I mean, it's tough anytime like, you know, a project kind of goes sour or quiet or whatever, you know, it's just like, that thing happens, you know, that I feel like when it happens with like a client project, it's like, oh, well, that sucks because I stopped getting paid for it, you know, but like that happens in business too. But when it's like a personal project, it's always, you know, it's like that someday, like box can just continue to sit there, but it's kind of like a mental weight as well, you know? So it's like, it's almost better to like put it away and be like, nope, this is for sure done. Or yes, I'm going to pick it up on X date.
Yeah. Well, do you have any examples of the sunken cost fallacy where you've continue with something even though you shouldn't because you've invested all this time, money, and effort, and you don't want to see that go to waste?
The amp hour. Ha ha. No. You know, I was very hesitant to give up the engineering commons when I was, you know, deciding whether or not to keep going with that. And, you know, I'd put it, I think it was like half a year into that. And luckily, Jeff kept it going. I was thinking about Jeff the other day. I got to reach out to him. But like, luckily I kept going, so like that made me feel better, but
it was
in a different state at that point too, right? I mean, like in it, and so I think leaving a project behind like that is like, yeah, you know, you, but to make it something new, to like make, to refresh it, or to like make it, to grow it bigger or finish it in your case, right, that sort of thing, it's like the sunk cost fallacy is like the real cost in the future is the work you still have to do, right? So
that's
what I think is what's out there. And if you're not interested or willing to do that, then it's like, yeah, then, you know, just put it aside and move on to the next thing or harvest it for another project at some point in the future.
Yeah. And it's not just hardware that it's not just, you know, projects that the sunken cost fallacy, it's also in investment as well. You go, oh, well, you know, I've been buying these shares and I put so much money in, I don't want to, you know, sell them because, you know, I'm going to, you know, you have to buy more because I've already put so much money into it. It's like, you know, sometimes you've just got to go, nah, you know, it's done. There's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
Especially if it doesn't interest you anymore. It's like, you know, so yeah, like there's times when I've been super hyped about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did a whole, two different video series on that. And it was like, at the time of doing that, I was hyped. And everyone goes, well, why don't you keep doing it? It's because, well, you know, it doesn't really interest me that much anymore.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, that's just the way it is. But anyway, so the plan is to get the hardware out. you know, show people where it is and then let people bitch in the comments that I'm not going to do anything with it. And, you know, it'll get it out of their system. And then, you know, and then, I've already released the source code. I actually released that like a year ago. The source code's been out there a long time. And I don't think I've released the latest schematic though. So I might actually release that. I might just dump it, you know, on the GitHubs for those who are interested in such things. And that might be that, unfortunately. So
hey, you know, like if you love something, let it free, and if it comes back to you, maybe it'll come back to you as a finished product.
Maybe, you know, I can buy it. Well, no, the thing is, like, I've already got one. I've already got a couple of finished products, and it works, right? Mm-hmm. It's just, so I've got the thing that I wanted, basically.
Yeah, right, so right. Yeah, so you were building it to scratch your own itch, right?
And yeah. I was building it to scratch my own itch. Yeah, and the itch is scratched. I've already got it, and I use it. You know, it's a cute little power supply, but it's not, the effort to go to actually produce it.
Yeah, it's not everything you wanted, right?
It's no, it's not. You know, it's evolved over time and it's changed. Mm-hmm. But it's actually more than what I wanted, actually, because it's USB power. This is what I originally wanted. This was the original thing, is that it took power from a USB input and gave you an adjustable power supply. That was it. Mm. That was it. And that's what it does. And it does that with quite a few bells and whistles. You know, it's got a big, nice display on it and a custom keypad. And, you know, it's a nice, sexy case and form factor and everything. Mm-hmm. So it's actually, it's actually done better than what I originally imagined. Because mine was just, you know, my original design was like, just a crusty old Jiffy box, you know. And
right, like, yeah, exactly. Know, yeah, right.
Board on top. So I'll try and dig out some of my original prototypes from like 12 years, because we're talking probably 12 years ago now.
Yeah, I mean, it was an early 10. The first 10 one was ago. Like an early set of series on the blog, right?
Yeah, I can remember. I was still working at Altium at the time, and I was working in, was it the old building? No, I was working at the new Altium building. I was working at Altium, and Leo Simpson from Silicon Chip Magazine came in. He was dropping by. I don't know. He wanted to see Altium or something, and he knew that I worked there, so he dropped by my little office cubicle, my Dilbert cubicle, you know, just chatting away. And I said, oh, by the way, I've been working on this little micro supply thing. Would you be interested in actually publishing this? And I showed him my little prototype and everything, and he thought it was great, you know. So, yeah, write up an article, you know, and we'll get it published and blah, blah. So I was actually reasonably close to getting that published too. But I sort of changed direction at the last minute or something, and I thought, oh, I'll just wait for this new version. And then there was another version on top of that. Yep. And then, so it never got published, unfortunately.
And there it goes, It takes on the mind of its own, right?
Right.
Yep. Yeah, that's tough, man. It's tough at the end of things.
Anyway.
Or making that decision's tough, I think, you know?
Right, yeah. It's like, I just don't have the time and the will to get it into a finished product. Like, I'm more interested in other stuff than that now. So that's just the way it is. Yeah. Yep. But then again, if I don't, like, I don't want it to just sit there. That's why I want to make a video on it, showing, like, here it is, the final thing. It got to this. Here's sort of like some old prototypes. Here's how it evolved and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And if you want to take it up, well, you know, here's some files. Go for it.
Yeah. Cool. That's
Knock
great,
yourself
man.
Out, but yeah.
I think that kind of thing's good, like a retrospective like that. That's good.
Yep. Last minute. Last calls. Drinks.
I got nothing else. People have been buying the Thermaltronics thing I recommended. That's nice. What did I see on your bench? Did you have a JBC on your bench?
I've got a JBC and a Pace, yeah.
Nice.
Although I'm actually using the Pace more than the JBC now. Yep.
Cool.
Yeah, need two soldering irons, by the way. You shouldn't just have one. You need two.
Yeah.
So then you can dual wield
exactly.
Flip little chips off and, yep.
Right, two. Yep. You should see three. This isn't even my final form.
boy. Can we talk? This could go on for a while.
All right. This teaser for next time, maybe. How about that?
Teaser for next time. There's been a lot of talk on the EV blog forum about the Fluke 87 multimeter and how they don't update it.
Oh.
And why.
Is it because they don't have firmware update capabilities? Someone's a big fan of that, personally.
Right. No, I'm talking about, like, releasing a new model.
Oh, like a new Rev.
Yeah,
oh.
The Fluke 87 has changed, right? It originally came out in 1988 as the Fluke 87, and then it was the Fluke 87-3, and they skipped the 2. They went to the 3, and then the Fluke 87-5 came out. So they've revised it a couple of times, but the Fluke 87-5 came out in 2004, I believe, or even slightly earlier, early 2000s. So it's getting close to 20 years old. They've been selling the exact same model for.
I could probably predict what the answer is. Which
what?
Is money. and when Papa Danaher doesn't want to spend any money to keep making money, so people keep buying the old one.
But they do release new models. So it's not like they're like as in other multimeters. So it's not like they're not working on new designs. Not like they don't have a design team with money to work on new designs. There's a reason.
Yeah, but why spend it if you're making money on the old one? If you can still source parts
exactly.
Everything else, like, who cares?
No.
I don't know.
I ultimately made this argument in the end. Here we go. We'll finish it off. Why not?
Okay.
Is that, okay, let's say they sell 100,000 Fluke 87s a year, right? It's still a very popular multimeter, right? It's as industry standard as you get, right? Everyone compares a multimeter with the 87.5, right? Yeah, it's still very popular. So let's say they sell 100,000 a year. Well, if they release a new model, is everyone who owns an 87.5 going to rush out and buy the new model? Most likely not, right? No. Because like they're very expensive for starters, right? And they just, you know, unless it's, I don't know, so radically different, which not many people are going to, their big customers aren't really going to accept, but that's another side argument.
I bet the big money's coming in from like just people who have it on a standard, like a standard list somewhere. They're like, our standard equipment is Fluke 87.5. Great.
The big money comes from government contracts and military contracts. They're the two big things. And and it's like, okay, they designed a new model. They're still going to sell. It's not like they're going to suddenly start selling double, right? Oh, it's not going to happen. There's not enough small buyers excited. You know, there's not enough multimeter enthusiasts so excited to spend $1,000, right?
There's I mean, there are collectors, but not like that.
Yeah, no.
Not enough of them to matter.
Not enough to matter. So they're still going to be selling 100,000 a year regardless, right? I'm making that figure up, right? But they're still going to be making the same amount regardless of whether or not they release a new model. All of your big buyers, they're all happy to buy the existing model, and they have been for 20 years, and they're still happy to buy it. So, yeah, that's one of the reasons not to rock the boat and actually release a new model. So,
yeah.
Anyway, there's more to it than that. There's more to it.
I am in complete agreement with you, but I think we will we'll put in the link to the forum thread.
The forum thread, yep.
Speculate there, yeah.
Excellent. No problem. All right. Debate away.
Cool. Yeah. Next week, we will have Sammy from Effinix, which is an FPGA company, on the show. So as a final reminder, please fill out the survey. Please fill out the survey and be creative.
Be creative in your comments.
Yeah. And creative and kind.
I don't care about kind.
Okay, then be creative.
I've got a dedicated hate mail address and I read
I know.
Because it's just fun. Yeah. People actually send email to my hate mail address just to see if I read it. they send an email. Oh, I'm sending this to your hate mail, but I really love your show and everything. I just want to see if you actually read your hate mail. And I actually reply, yep. You know? Yeah. So, yep. Love it.
All right.
Anyway, that's it.
Hi, Dave. Talk to you soon.
Catch you next time.
Love it or hate it, that was our show. And let's be honest, if you got this far, you probably didn't hate all of it. A reminder that we love our patrons. You can become one of them by joining the crowd in the Discord channel at patreon.com/theamphour. We'd also love it if you remember to fill out the survey. Thanks.